good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Coming soon to the California Theater in San Bernardino, it's Legends of R&B, Soul, and Rock and Roll with information at affordablemusicproductions.com. The lineup includes Lou Christie, Jay and the Americans, and Little Anthony and the Imperials. We'll be hearing from Little Anthony later this evening, though first a return to Lou Christie. We heard most of the conversation last week, and you can find it at kvcrnews.org/arts. There were some really nice memories, though, that I wanted to make sure got shared, though my first question for Lou was not so much of a question as it was a request. I just wanted to hear him say his full name. Just as I told him, it was far more syllables than I was counting on.
Luigi Alfredo Giovanni Sacco.
Oh, my God. A very Italian Pittsburgh.
Very, very, very Italian, yes. Okay. And my mother was Polish.
We're about to jump to today, but before I go there, I just have to know about Leslie Gore. You did a recording, I don't know if it was sometime in the 80s, 90s, or when this was.
Oh, it's the best. You've got to get on and hear it. Click on to Facebook. It was just, we closed every concert with it. Because we've known each other since 1962, so she had It's My Party, and I
right.
Just cried. So we've known each other all these years, and, you know, ups and downs and arounds, and oh, my God. But then we got together, I guess it was in the 80s or something. Probably the 80s. And we were on a bill together and said, let's do something else. Let's figure out, because we were doing a big show with Chuck Berry and I don't know who else was on the show, and Leslie and me. And this was my big return back to this country because I was living in Europe.
Right.
And so we came back and we worked on this thing called Since I Don't Have You and It's Only Make Believe. And we had about 6 concerts coming up together, and we said we were playing Madison Square Garden, so we did it there, and we had 22,000 people just went wild. We worked on the arrangement until we had it just right, because she was like I was. It has to be the right arranger, or we just don't bother with it, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't go out there and wing it, because we both came from knowing what good singing was and what good arrangers were. And she was very much into jazz singing, Billie Holiday, Donna Washington, Sarah Vaughan. So she had a quality about her that just tapped me. I got her and she got me, you know.
Yeah.
And when we wrote this thing and did the arrangement of it, we closed the show with it. There wasn't a person sitting down anymore. And we did it for, I don't know how many years, about 10 years when we would be booked together. And we would close the concerts with it, you know. And she and I really had a thing where it became a little too Stephen Eady, and it made her a little nervous. So it became a thing, you know. We just kept working throughout the years together, and then she got instantly sick. And
Yeah.
We were just working on some new stuff we were doing, and I didn't even know. She didn't even know it at the time. That was like about a month, or three, oh yeah, about a month before she just took sick.
Oh, my gosh.
And I still have, I just had some of the music recopied because her apartment had a fire in there and lost all the music and everything like that.
Oh.
Lost all the stuff in New York, you know.
My hopes, my dreams come true. My life I'd give for you. My heart, a wedding ring. My all, my everything. My heart.
And I had a phone call, and my manager said, Leslie died. I said, Leslie who?
Oh, no.
He said, yeah, and I said, I don't believe this. I just couldn't believe it. I said, I was sending her an email at the time the phone call came in. And I was just, and they said, and Dick, my manager who was handling us, and said, Leslie, I just got a call. Leslie died. I said, oh, my God. And that was it. I never sent the email. There was nothing to send. I mean, because I stopped in the middle of the whole thing and said, well, I couldn't believe it. And she just died literally within, like, 3 weeks. Just took over her, and that was it. But she was a talent. I loved the sound of her voice. And Leslie could sing. She was a great singer. She didn't have the power, but she didn't need the power because she had this husky, wonderful quality about her voice.
Yep.
And she knew how to sing. You know, there are people that I know that can sing and people that can't because they have an instinct about how they got to sing that line.
Yes.
How they have to sing it, how they have to, you know. And she had that knowledge and that instant thing about she knew how to sing a song, you know. She was wonderful. She could sing a standard. It was great, you know. She just had that quality. She was one of those singers that I really appreciated, really working with her, because she rose to the occasion all the time for me.
Let's go forward just a little bit. Tell me about
Pledging My Love, or listen to The Turquoise Trail. The Turquoise Trail is wonderful. I don't know. So I retreat and I go out to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and get out of New York City to get off the grid.
Yeah.
So I go out there, and I just love it out there. And, you know, I drive from Albuquerque and up to Santa Fe, and I take the Turquoise Trail. It's the back roads. And I go up there, and I just love it out there. And it's so funny because Abby Neal and the Ranch Girls from the world's original WWBA, their theme song when I was 8 years old was Riding Down to Santa Fe. And that was their theme song. I just, you know.
So it's burn the trail and yonder we'll go. We're riding down to Santa Fe. Hey, we're riding down to Santa Fe.
Hi, I'm Abby Neal and all the Ranch Girls are back to entertain you for some more tunes, I guess, along about 30 minutes or so.
On Pledging My Love, what was the song that was, say, maybe the driving force for the record, or maybe the first one recorded that made you go, oh, I've got to get 79 minutes worth of stuff out there. It's time to do it. What was the first one that got in there for Pledging My Love?
We had it all like rainbows and wine. Come back again. Come back again.
You know, I don't know. It was just time to do some new stuff, you know.
Okay.
There wasn't one record.
Okay.
I think of 20 records a day. I can write a show. Just about every 2 days, I could come up with a whole new show that I could do, you know, but
you're
I give the ideas and it drives me crazy sometimes.
Okay.
I love music and it never leaves my mind and I'm not even aware of that I'm singing. People say, oh, all you do is sing, and I said, I'm not aware that I even sing.
Oh.
So it's like breathing to me, I don't know. There wasn't one song that I could say, oh, I've got to do. You know, I loved that record, Pledging My Love. That was great. But then there was some of the other things, the last couple things we wrote together were on there. You know, What Happened to the Night.
What happened to the night? 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 What happened to the night?
And then I wrote a couple things with a friend of mine, Artie, a techno pop. That's really cool. And every song, believe me, is handpicked. I just don't.
Good,
I don't want to put something I think, well, that's nice, but it's not really that. I really fall in love with each song that I either write or that I want to sing. I mean, it was a little more commercial way back there when they were always trying to. The business people try to stick their hands in my pockets all the time, you know,
right.
Try to direct me so they could collect the money and they could do the, you know, it's like every time they did that, it would just be a disaster because it would not work.
Wow.
Because the impetus, it had to come from me and my soul. If I believed it, I had to fall in love with it. You know, I had to love it and I didn't want to sound like someone else. I wanted to be original.
Good, yes.
When you get creativity, you have to have an innocent quality about what you're doing and really believe it, you know.
Truly, yes.
You have to feel it, you know.
That's Lou Christie, part of the lineup with legends of R&B, soul, and rock and roll, coming to the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd. Information at affordablemusicproductions.com. The lineup also includes Jay and the Americans and Little Anthony and the Imperials. We'll be hearing from Little Anthony a little later in the program. You're listening to KBC Arts on 91.9 KBCR, also at kbcrnews.org. Let's jump to today. Since we're approaching a concert with you, Jay and the Americans, and Little Anthony, it's not like anybody's opening up for the other. This is a concert of three headliners. So knowing that sharing the bill, your portion on the stage will be a bit shorter, although aren't you going to be emceeing as well?
Well, that's the thing. They've worked this out where I am hosting it. The first person you'll see is me when I walk out there. We haven't worked out how do I do this exactly, but my feeling is that if I'm going to be going out there first and da-da-da-da-da and talking, and I have to introduce people, so I believe I will walk out and do my shtick. And I said, I guess I go out here and do my show.
Yeah.
After I do my opening thing or whatever I do, you know. And then I think I'll introduce the Americans, and then I'll introduce Little Anthony. So it's not really, really that bad for me. I'm fine, you know, because I love Anthony, and I've worked with Anthony and since 1961.
Wow.
Or something. We've known each other. You know, we worked in Vegas together, and he and I together for months at a time. And he's so good and so professional. Those guys, and you know, there are people that are really just deserve that spotlight and have worked for it, you know.
Yeah.
And Anthony is one of those people. He's always professional, always was, and always will be. And a hard worker. And he and I make a good combination, whatever it is.
Nice.
I just have a personality that I work the show a little differently, you know.
Sure.
I'm not looking at it as like, oh, my God, I have to open it. Because
oh, no.
I'm the host of it, too. So
yeah.
That's how it all sort of fell into position, you know. Because, you know, you get into it and say, well, I'm closing. I'm not letting someone else close over me. I'm not looking at it.
With these three acts, it's so much of a coin toss, except there's three. You could easily have any of you first, second, or third. Like I said, it's three headliners.
Right.
So you're going to be talking, and I suppose I want to know what the first song you're going to break into when you're speaking.
Oh,
you're just suddenly going to go into lightning strikes?
I don't know, because time-wise, that could change, because I have a couple different things I can slot in the opener. I still want to rock and roll with you, or not. I may not do that one. I may open with I'm going to make you mine, or I may open with lightning striking again. I haven't worked that out yet.
So you don't have a standard opener closer. It sort of felt
out. I do, but it all depends on how long I have on the show, where I'm at in the show. I don't want to throw 3 minutes away or 4 minutes away with something if I only have a half hour on the stage.
Yes.
Because you have to do Lightning. You have to do Gypsy Cry. You have to do Rhapsody in the Rain. You have to do Two Faces of Fire.
Yes.
You have to do I'm Gonna Make You Mine. You know, so you have to really figure out, do I do the medley of three songs together, and then I can maybe open up with something. I have to take that as each show goes on, time-wise, and that's how it works.
Let's put it this way then, Lou. With, you know, we know that we have to have the hits. But what about, say, some of the new ones that we haven't had time for them to be hits? Do you include those in this kind of a show?
No.
Okay.
No, only because, you know, I study people and their careers.
Mm-hmm.
Diana Ross to Judy Garland. Now, I saw Judy Garland a few times. Judy Garland got a standing ovation after every song she started and ended, except the new songs that she put in.
Oh.
People sat there and listened and watched her and did not get a standing ovation.
Get in touch.
Now you take it from there.
Yeah.
Unless something is so over the top, I may stick it in at a moment in the show and make sure it's effective enough that I could do it. Like I do an Italian thing in Italian that I wrote for a movie.
Cool.
And every once in a while, if it's the right evening and something, I'll just go right into it. I don't even explain it. I just start singing in Italian. And then you think, oh, my God, and it just works. But it all is part of show business. It's always how do you present yourself. And that's always the magic of it, as far as I'm concerned. Here's a story for you.
Oh, good.
When I lived in Hollywood, I went to Tony Bennett's opening at the Coconut Grove. All right, that night I go and I meet Natalie Wood and Warren Beatty.
Ooh.
And I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is Hollywood to the utmost degree. You know, I mean, it's like, I couldn't believe it. I had a suntan on. I had my new suit. It was, like, really great. It was fantastic. So I said, oh, my God. Then they bring up Judy Garland. I meet Judy Garland. And they say, Judy Garland would like you to meet Lou Christie. And she's, oh, I love your songs. No, records, she said. I said, oh, my God, how in the hell does she know me? I had nothing to say after that. I said, well, I mean, what was I supposed to say? You like my records? How do you know even what my records are? I mean, I only had at that point a couple. Well, Lightning was big at that point, maybe Rhapsody or something, but Gypsy, I don't know how she would remember, you know. Judy Garland telling me that she liked my records. And I'm there with 14 versions of Judy at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like you're kind of blown away by this experience even today.
You know why? Because I still love watching people in the wings and watching the show. And I don't know, you just learn and you see and you watch and, you know. And I think one of the main people in my life was for watching someone who was magical was Diana Ross. I knew it when I first met her, too. But when I saw her on television once, I said, oh, my God, this girl has got something that no one is going to catch. I knew she was going to be a monster star. I mean, I sat there with her on the bus, and I said, I just knew it. And I just watched her climb right up to number one because she just had that magic. When she walks out on that stage, there was just something about her that just surpassed everyone else.
They had an elegance about them and a very commanding stage presence.
Oh, sure. But she had something that was untouchable. And I thought her face was magnificently original. That mouth of hers, those lips, the eye, I mean, just the eye, the whole thing. She was magical to me. She really was. And I had such a crush on her.
Who wouldn't? Funny.
And I loved people like Peggy Lee because she was such an artist. She knew exactly what she was going to do and how to do it on stage.
Mm-hmm.
How to captivate you, how to keep you interested. I'd always wondered. I knew her, and I had pictures taken and things like that. And I knew her when I lived in Hollywood. That I talked about her, how soft she sang. And she said, you know how hard it is to sing this soft? And I said, yeah, I know, because she could keep you so interested by just talking very low and whispering. And, you know, she was captivating.
Yeah.
But that takes a genius behind there to do that. She kept everyone interested right to the end, you know. I love those kind of artists. You know, they're unique.
That was Lou Christie, part of the lineup with legends of R&B, soul, and rock and roll coming to the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd. Information at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org.
Welcome to Shout, Black Gospel Music Moment. I'm Robert Darden. Sometimes the vinyl 45 itself is as interesting as the music it contains. Take, for instance, an extraordinarily moving rendition of the old spiritual Walk Around Heaven by the otherwise unknown Divine Messenger Chorale. Man, this is powerful stuff. Musically, it begins slowly and mournfully, then it builds to a passionately defiant climax. You see, the lyrics of Walk Around Heaven are in the form of a wish list by slaves, telling the listener their dreams of a better world to come. Most slaves worked, as they said, from can to can't. 7 days a week, and the idea of walking around heaven all day with no work was just that, heavenly. With its bright red label, the 45 itself is on the equally obscure Divine Spirituals label out of Memphis, and you can hear that soulful Memphis sound in the accompanying instrumentation. The label states, dedicated to Lois DeBerry. DeBerry is one of the longest-serving African-American legislators in American history. DeBerry, who was from Tennessee, was also a participant in the Civil Rights Movement. Representative Lois DeBerry died at the young age of 68 in 2013, taken from us much too soon. Knowing that makes the opening lines of this ancient spiritual all the more poignant. One of these mornings, and it won't be very long, you will look for me, and I'll be gone. I'm Robert Darden. Shout, Black Gospel Music Moments, is produced by KWBU, the Black Gospel Music Restoration Project at Baylor University Libraries, and is funded by generous support from the Pritchard Foundation.
You can hear Shout each Sunday morning during Weekend Edition and here on KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Coming up April 22nd at the California Theater in San Bernardino, Affordable Music Productions presents Legends of R&B, Soul, and Rock and Roll with Lou Christie, Jay and the Americans, and Little Anthony and the Imperials. And with Little Anthony, he was by no means the only one in the family with music as part of his life.
Yeah, my mother was a gospel singer, with the Nazareth Baptist gospel singers, her sisters and herself. And my dad was an alto tenor player, and he played with Buddy Johnson's orchestra, quite a few orchestras at that time in the 40s.
Oh, cool.
And all of my brothers were musicians. There's music every day, and they tell me that my great-grandfather was a great singer. So it stands to reason it fell down on me.
Now, I want to sort out the timeline on this as far as Tears on My Pillow. Was this once you were already the Imperials, or was this right before becoming the Imperials?
It's complicated. That's why I have it in my book. In fact, I might as well tell you, the book is called My Journey, My Destiny.
Oh, yes.
Little Anthony. But that's on Amazon. A lot of times I'm interviewed, it's almost like people don't realize that close to 60 years have gone by, or more. It's so far that the human mind can remember every little detail, you know? Or does it want to remember all the other details?
Right.
You know, a great comedian, her name was Moms Mabley, said, you ask her, well, how do you feel about the good old days? She says, this is the good old days. And that's how I look at it. So I don't spend a lot of time in it because I'm 76 years old. That was when I was 16, 17.
Yeah.
I can relate to that person. Because I'm not that person anymore.
Right.
That's something that Chuck Berry had a problem with. He wouldn't do interviews. Because the man was a gazillion years old. And I asked him, like, it's just yesterday, questions about that and that and that. I don't know of any performer or a person being interviewed don't have a problem with that. Unless somebody hits a nerve. Like something that's very pertinent to that particular time.
Sure.
Or a specific artist that helped them through, or something to that effect. In fact, the great George Burns used to say, they would ask me, I would be interviewed, and ask me the same questions happened in 1922. He said, and then I began to lie. I changed the story every time. So I don't really linger there much. I can do the best I can, but I cannot. It's just that there was so much I lived, you know?
Certainly.
And so there's no specific thing that I can nail down about my life other than I'm a blessed dude. I know that I never expected to be where I am. I never expected to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I never expected to sell so many millions of records. I never expected that. I just was doing something that urban kids do in the city, especially black kids. We just did what we did in our little community. Like today they have all the rappers.
Yeah.
That's what they do today. When I came up, it was all singing groups. It started with the Ink Spots, and then it went to the Ravens, then it went to the Orioles, then it went to the Orioles, then it went to the Flamingos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it grew. So a lot of times I tell people, R&B is the mother who gave birth to rock and roll.
Yeah, well, yeah,
so
certainly.
I like to cover it in those more broader sense, because when people ask me, so when did you start?
Right,
I started.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's like, I don't know. I mean, it's just, I was singing since I was 3 years old. And so there were so many facets in that journey that I've been on that it's very difficult for me to nail certain things. Like you just asked that question. A lot of people don't know it, and probably a lot of people who do. But there are a lot of people who don't, or they really care. There are so many different names about groups and stuff.
Sure.
Somehow somebody called, when I came to the guys, the Chesters. I don't know why. I have no clue. They were just called the Chesters.
Okay.
So when we got to contract at Gordon and Records from George Goldner, they didn't like the name. They changed it to the Imperials. And
okay.
That came from.
All right. One thing about that, then, this was such a huge hit right away. You didn't even have to work your way toward good sales. This was an instant million seller.
And I was an instant hit guy, too. I've been at it 3 or 4 years before that.
Oh, yeah?
And let me tell you, so I failed every time.
Okay.
So This does not happen as a surprise and overnight. This was more of a determination, and I wanted to do it, and I loved it, and I have a passion for the business. But I didn't one day walk in and became Little Anthony. In fact, I didn't even have a name called Little Anthony. It was given to me by Alan Tree.
Right.
And the group name was the Chesters, then it became the Imperials. And so all these things happen on their own time and the way it's planned in one's life. So I don't like to be too philosophical, but when you get my age, you really become philosophical. Because you've seen so much and you've experienced so much, it becomes a point that you want to be as accurate as you can, but sometimes it's difficult because so many years have passed and so many things have happened. It's difficult. That's why I like to stay on today. What am I doing now? Where am I going? What's my plans? It's history. You can easily Google where I started from and what I did and what school I went to and who I did. You can do that automatically. But in my mind, I tend to be much more practical and pragmatic about now. What am I doing now? Because it's important about what I'm doing now, because if I don't explain that, then I'm not going to have a now, and then I'll be dead and gone. Mm. You know what I mean? So I don't know if people understand that. And then, like I said, it's never my intention to belittle anything that I did. No, it was profound. But there's so many times you can answer those questions.
Oh, certainly. In all honesty, Anthony, really, I do know that people can look stuff up and read the facts and the whens. And so really, a lot of the things that I hope to hear from you are more of a philosophical driven, or how you felt about something or that kind of thing. So that's what I really hope for anyway. So that's great.
I enjoy that. I mean, I like so much. I have such a thirst for life and I'm very blessed. And so many good things. Man, tell you the truth, I'm doing better now than I did then.
Wow.
Yeah, financially and everything is better. When I came up as a kid, we were dealing with Jim Crow and segregation, and it was bad. It wasn't fun when you had to go through the South or places where that happened. You had some, like I said, I wrote all that stuff in the book, so I wanted to give more detail.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's easier to just take your time and write it down and say, okay, this happened and that happened in my life. You know, I'm glad you said that, because I'm so wrapped up in today and what I'm doing and things that I've accomplished, things that I'm attempting to accomplish. I twist something. I think I said, I realize that I cannot live yesterday anymore. It's gone. It's gone. This conversation will be gone. Once you hang up the phone, we had that conversation, and it'll be recorded. Thank goodness they have that kind of technology. But in real life, that conversation goes in the air somewhere into the universe. Who knows where?
Right.
It's over.
That's Little Anthony at the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd, along with Jay and the Americans and Lou Christie. Information and tickets at affordablemusicproductions.com. Just ahead, how Anthony was stuck changing clothes in a restaurant kitchen before a gig, and how John Gotti's mother helped to change that. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. This is a story your son alluded to, but I'd like to hear it from you, your perspective.
Okay.
I'm hoping that you could tell us about this restaurant that you sang at, and you had a change in the kitchen until this particular woman...
Oh, that's cool, man. Yeah, it was really bad. Okay, all right. You know, I lived in New York, and then obviously the boys live in New York and Chicago and all that. When I'm talking about organized crime, there was a place that I played called the Brown Derby in Brooklyn, in Bay Ridge area, which is predominantly Italian, and it was the headquarters of some of the Godfathers and the mob in that area, or the families that were in that area. I found out later that the restaurant that I perform at was actually owned by John Gotti. It was like a you know, how they laundered stuff and money out of them. But anyway, I got booked, and so, okay, you know, it was a gig. So I go there, and I walk in the place. I got all these $3,000 uniforms. So I said to them, okay, thank you. I said, well, where's the dressing room at? Well, we don't got no dressing room. Is there like an office or somewhere where I can change? No, everybody, they all change in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody changes in the kitchen. But, sir, I'm not everybody. I mean, I got $2,000 worth of...
Yeah.
Somebody walks by me with a pizza pie or a spaghetti, I'm done. You know, I have to get to my clothes. And how do I do that with all these people running back and forth? And the guy said to me, whoever it was that was there, he said, Well, that's how we do it. I said, well, that's not the way I do it. And so I got a little upset. Well, what happened was she was a big fan. That's how I got in there.
Mm.
She was a big fan, and she had heard this was happening. And then the guy came back and says, hey, you know, we'll take care of you. We're going to put you in a hotel room right there under the Barrazzano Bridge. So I didn't know what it was until later I thought it was her. She thought, she said, you let him, do not put him in the kitchen. Do you know who he is? You know what I mean? And that's what happened. And now I find out all this, and then I find out about John Gotti and the Gambino family. I'm going, oh, my goodness. I could have been history. You know? Man. And then here's a wild part about it. I met a couple of the guys at Compost,
okay,
his people, his soldiers, and they told me one of the things that one of the guys said, that guy got guts.
Mm.
You know, they respect that. Yeah, he's got guts. You know? Wow. I didn't mean to have any guts. I just thought I'm dressing in the kitchen. But it did happen. Yes, it did.
Thank you for sharing that on tape. And I'm glad you told me that you were not aware of just who she was until well after the fact.
No.
Oh, beautiful.
I didn't know.
Beautiful.
I met her after the show. She invited me to the table, and it was his mother. Oh, my gosh.
That's cool.
So finally, one of the musicians told me, do you know who that is? I said, I don't know. To me, it's a gig.
She's the lady that got me a dressing room.
I'm from Brooklyn. I'm in Bay Ridge. Right off the bat, I should have thought, this could be the mob's hangout. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. I just wasn't thinking. And then when I found out about it, but she was so gracious, so nice.
Nice.
She tried to make it up every way she knew. And from that point on, everybody that was in that club treated me with the greatest respect you can possibly be. I actually met John Gotti, too, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. At the time, I didn't know he was going to be John Gotti.
Well,
I'm not trying to figure him out. Well, he's gone now. So, but
yeah.
He was the heir apparent to the Gambino family.
Yeah.
Carlo Gambino. If you're from New York, I don't know where you're from, but from Brooklyn, New York, guys in New York, and the Five Boroughs, we all know who's who, you know?
You know, I think Duke Ellington was once asked if he had anything to say about the mob. He was quiet for a second and then said, no, I'm not going to say anything about my friends.
Well said, Duke.
Yeah.
New York is new. If you mind your business, you really wouldn't get caught up in anything.
You were a civilian, yeah. One more kind of mob-related thing. We thought this was a music thing. So it's Frank Sinatra and Morris Levy related, so by proxy, I suppose it's mob-related.
They weren't. Morris Levy was the president of a record company called Roulette Records.
Mm-hmm.
Which his subsidiaries was Gone and End Records, and he was in partnership with George Goldner, who was the president of Gone and End Records, and my career started through Richard Barrett, who was an A&R man there. But I found out later that actually George broke away from Morris Levy, who everybody in New York called Mersch. So Morris was affiliated with the mob, okay? I guess where his money came. And I actually put in a book, it was Frank Sinatra who got me out of a contract that Morris Levy had me under and would not release me. Now, you say to yourself, Frank Sinatra? I have never met the man. I just seem to run across people who were associated with him. And one was Don Costa, who wanted to record me on his new record company called DCP, Don Costa Production. And that's where we had those songs going on my head, Hurt So Bad, Take Me Back, I Miss You So.
Okay.
And on and moving on. And in order, and when they asked us, does anybody have a contract, everybody raised their hand and said, no, we don't. And I said, I got a contract. It was Morris Levy. And I remember Don Costa in the office saying, oh, gosh. Look, I'll call you back in a few days. Well, they call us back in, and he goes in his drawer, and he fixates, I got your contract. And I'm going, how did you do that? Did Morris Levy don't let nobody go, you know, because he was such a, the mob, you couldn't do it. Once you sign a contract with him, you're signed for life. But what I found out later on, Teddy Randazzo told me, he says, oh, no, he says, Don called Frank. Remember, Don Costa was his arranger at that time and producer. And so that's the relationship he had with Frank Sinatra was strong. And he told him what the problem was, and Sinatra says, I'll call you back. And the next thing you know, we got the release. Well, obviously, Sinatra's had a lot of power.
Wow.
In that area. And there were phone calls made, and he says he's released.
Wow. And you had never met the man at this point, Sinatra?
No, I met his daughter, Nancy. I met his son, Frank Sinatra Jr. For some reason, I never met the man, but I feel like I did. It's weird.
That's Little Anthony at the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd, along with Jay and the Americans and Luke Christie. Information and tickets at affordablemusicproductions.com. More with Anthony just ahead. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. I spoke with Eugene Pitt maybe some 9 months ago and asked him to describe the scene there in Brooklyn, a few blocks away from you, and, you know, singing around the Burn Barrel under the street lamp. What kind of a scene was it? Was this like every weekend this would happen, every night? Describe the scene for me, please.
It would happen frequently because we were urban kids on the street. We didn't have a lot. We didn't have money. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot to do, but we found, just like kids today with rap, that, you know, we started singing and we had no place to sing. We actually went down into the subways because there was echo down in there from the tiles in the subway. And actually, we started that whole thing in the subways that today still exists. They're called subway performance. And you would sing a great. People, if you put your hat on, they put money in your hat, like they really liked it. And then we would sit in the parks, on the street lamps, everything. That's why they called it Street Corner Harmony.
Mm.
There was no such thing as doo-wop. I got heard of that. So 1973, when the well-known disc jockey was trying to explain that era, and I won't give his name, because he's long gone, he can't defend himself. He didn't know what to tell people what was going on. But he remembered that some of these groups that had that sound, doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-wop-a-doo-wop, whatever.
Sure.
And so he called it doo-wop. So it's not doo-wop. There's no such thing as doo-wop. We have a tendency to label anything that we don't understand. So that way it gives us an idea of what we want to do, especially in America. And so they called it doo-wop. I mean, there's no such thing. All of the old times, and those are still alive, and I'm one of the last few that can actually say this to people. I've had people tell me, well, it's got to be doo-wop. I said, excuse me, can I tell you something? It's not doo-wop. You know why? I was there in the beginning, okay? So if I were you, I would take for gospel what I'm saying, literally. It's the truth. If you want to know the truth, there it is. People don't like the truth because it gets in the way of facts. You know, I just always love to make that clear. I guess if you want to be called doo-wop, fine. That's cool, but not me and what the work that we did. In fact, they didn't put us in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and induct us in there as doo-wop group. We were inducted there as an R&B pop group. There's no category for doo-wop in all of that. I always tell people, whatever gig, do not put that label on me. I'm not against it. It's just not who we are. It would do a disservice to the great writers, Teddy Randazzo, Bobby Hart, all these wonderful people who've done great stuff. It's got nothing to do with that. Going out of my head, that's doo-wop? Okay, that's
why
I cleared that up.
I mean, whether we're looking at movements in art or periods of jazz, for example, you know, like the guys that were playing jazz fusion, they didn't call it jazz fusion. It was named after the fact. So I completely understand and respect what you're saying there.
We have to label things to understand it. In this country, I don't know about other countries, but we do. They're not like Europeans or Asians or South America, where they really honor things that are sacred and they keep it up.
Mm-hmm.
Not us. If it gets in the way of a new building going up to make money, it's gone. It's gone. Unless we do something about it, it's gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, we appreciate history, and we love it until we can make a bigger dollar somewhere. So,
We're not putting us down with this kind of how we roll. But, you know, sometimes, look at what they did with the Apollo. They made it a national treasure, which was great.
Yes, yes.
You know? So one of the few national treasures. And if they do that, that'd be nice. There's a lot of great stuff out there, man. It should never be torn down because it has so much history and it's great education for children and everything else. So we just got to be careful. Sometimes you want to make that money so much you forget.
By the way, your son is Tony. So is he little Anthony?
No, he's Tony Gordy. That's his name. My other son, Tony, was feeling ill. My other son filled in for him, Andre. He's downstairs waiting for me to go to eat. And he filled in. It's almost like a family thing. These kids were raised up backstage. So I couldn't think of a better person to run my business with the kids that were raised backstage.
Yeah, absolutely. Something you mentioned just a few moments ago about being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was Smokey Robinson that inducted you.
Well, he presented us.
Presented. But you have a long history with him, right?
I didn't know he was going to be there when we got there. Mr. Stewart, one of the executives, told me, Smokey wants to introduce you. He wanted to. In fact, when he did the introduction that was recorded, you can YouTube it, he was very sick. He had a high temperature.
Oh.
But he said, I wanted to represent these guys and present them because we've known each other since 1959. To this day, I talk to Smokey now and then. Yeah, we run into each other. But we're like brothers. And he said that in the induction, if you see it. These are my brothers, band of brothers. So we knew them guys from day one. It was a mutual respect, and yes, he is my brother. He's my brother in show business. We came up together. We know the hurts, the feelings, the successes, the failures. We know it all because we both experienced it.
I had understood that you had, a long relationship, but going back to 1959, how did that come about, you guys together?
Barry Gordy used to work for Brunswick Records. He was a writer, but he was trying to put together a little something himself, become independent. But he couldn't make it. It was really tough in New York, you know? And he was from Detroit. And Smokey, as I was told, legend tells, that Smokey and his family and Barry's family were very close. And Smokey was an upper-middle-class cat. He was not a hood dude, you know? Yeah. And his family had some money. And that's how that relationship stopped. They actually, Smokey helped stake Barry in starting, you guess what, Motown.
Yep.
Well, that's a good investment.
that's a good thing to have on the resume, I'd say.
Yeah. They were trying to get a deal with George Goldner at Goldner End Records, and I actually walked in the room and to the office, and Pete Moore, one of the original Miracles, was there, and Smokey came in, and I didn't even know who Smokey was.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I kind of knew, because they had this first record, was called, it was like, it was the big hit, but it made noise.
Okay, yeah.
But I can't remember who that was, but they were trying to get, whatever, backing, financial, whatever, and he couldn't get it. So that's when I met him, actually in that office, and then they went to Detroit, and the rest is history.
A long history there. That is so nice that he came back around. It's almost a full circle thing, if you will, for him to ask to introduce you. And you said that he was really sick at that point, too.
Yeah, he had a fever. The reason I found it out, one of the imperials told me, I was talking to Smokey, man. And he was sick, but he said, I'm not going to miss this. I'm coming. That meant a lot to us and meant a lot to me. It showed me the kind of man Smokey is. This is a very... very cool dude, and I'm glad to be called his friend.
That's Little Anthony at the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd, along with Jay and the Americans and Lou Christie. Information and tickets at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. A couple of years ago, literally just a couple of years ago, there was a 55th anniversary and farewell tour. I'm glad it wasn't truly farewell. Was that the Imperials? Certainly not for you.
No, it wasn't farewell tour. It was the 55th anniversary of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, the farewell.
It wasn't farewell. That reminds me of Barbara Streisand. She went on her fourth farewell tour.
Yes.
When you hear bands say, my farewell tour, don't take it literally.
Yeah. It's just the last one till next year.
No, it's our 55th anniversary. I don't wear the farewell tour, okay?
Okay.
Again, the people who add on. Now you've got it for me.
Okay, well, let's look at the most current thing then. We will be seeing you April 22nd at the California Theater in San Bernardino. That's just down the road from where I am right now.
Yeah, my old life to live in L.A.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out, did I ever play this place? I'll find out when I get there, because I always remember when I walk in the place, I go, man, I played there before. This is with Lou Christie and Jane American.
Yeah.
Should be fun.
Oh, yes. We're looking at it as three headliners, one show.
Yeah, One big bang. Big bang. I think it runs about 3 hours.
Yeah. So I guess one more thing then. This is just a nice thing to close with, I think. And it's often something that I try to guess at anyway, but I'm guessing it and asking you directly. So as far as openers, closers, do you have any kind of a standard set list that you would go with? Is Tears on My Pillow, is that the big thing to close with or to grab people's attention with and open with?
Heck no. The reason why we've been so successful, we are a performing act.
Okay.
We transition from a recording star to performing stars. I'm a professional. I'm going to go out there and the people are going to enjoy it because I believe it and I enjoy it. I mean, we don't live on our laurels. Like I just told you, I don't live in the past. I don't live on that. I'm going to sing Tears on My Pillow 900 times.
Okay.
It's a part of who I am. So not used to say something because people ask me, sing I'll Never Smile Again. Now, he did not I'll Never Smile Again during 1941, during the war.
Mm-hmm.
He was a kid. Yeah. So he was with the Hoboken Five.
Yes.
His singing group. And he said, do they understand how old I am? That was 65 years ago. But human nature is always, you know, the average person wants, they grow old, but they don't want those things that they admire to grow old.
Right.
Well, I understand perfectly why they do that. They do it, it's unconscious. So you don't get mad at anybody, but you explain it like Sinatra did. No, we do everything from Sting to you name it. Man, Hurts So Bad, all those different songs, Gone on My Head, Tears on My Pillow. Heck, we do Shimmy Shimmy Coco, but it's a show. We close with Every Breath You Take, The Police. And it's a huge winner. People stand up and they dance. We're not caught up in that. Like I said, we transition from recording stars to performing stars. Unfortunately, 90% of my peers in those days did not do that. They still sing their same songs over and over again. And that's all they do. That's why they got caught up in that doo-wop world and theme shows. And that's
right.
What they do. They can't break away. Because they never made that next step. And we did.
Well, that's one of the things that made you so wonderfully successful. You know, looking at, say, just the TV shows that you appeared on, for example. That's so many through the years. Ed Sullivan, that goes back to the mid-60s, mm-hmm. I suppose. But then American Bandstand, Merv Griffin, The Tonight Show.
Kraft Music Hall. Oh, we did them all.
Yeah.
The Tonight Show. But they didn't put us on there because they want to be nice to us. They put us on there because we earned it.
Yeah, yep.
So what you won't see, 90% of the little groups and stuff, they're not on those shows because they just never earned it. They never did something that made everybody look up and say, wow, man, you see what they just did? You see that when they just recorded? Going out of my head, my gosh. I've had people come and tell me, hey, man, you know, can you do Traveling Stranger? And I look at them again. I think I'm Sinatra. Man, I was a baby. I don't do that. I've grown past that.
Do you still listen to Jimmy Scott?
Yeah, Jimmy. Jimmy passed away a couple of years ago. Jeannie, his wife, and I stayed close.
Ah, wonderful.
She just moved to Maine, I think. She just sent me a thing. She's moved. She sold what they had in Las Vegas. In fact, a few of us would go down to his shows when he was working in Las Vegas.
Nice.
Jimmy was my idol. He was Frank Sinatra's idol. Frank loved him. And also Frankie Lyman of the Teenagers followed
him and
learned from him. Nancy Wilson, I talked with her. She learned from him. I learned from him. Michael Jackson learned from him. He was the most unique voices that ever God put on this earth. Whew, gosh, I was just listening. Well, I was on YouTube or something, and he did My Funny Valentine. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. I know the recording.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I when you listen to it over and over, you go, oh, come on.
That's Little Anthony at the California Theater in San Bernardino, April 22nd, along with Jay and the Americans and Lou Christie. Information and tickets at affordablemusicproductions.com. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Lou Christie and Little Anthony, as well as to Nathan Gothels for setting up the interviews. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Boyd, and Mike Pesavento. Beyond the Music, Lou Christie and Little Anthony and the Imperials, Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, For Example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcrnews.org/arts. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.